Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club Podcast. This is your host, Joe Sibilia, and today I have the pleasure of talking with somebody who has quite literally written the book, or rather multiple books, on the Friars Club. He is the former communications director of the Friars Club and is a Friars Club historian. He's written the New York Friars Club Book of Roasts and another great book called 100 Years, A Million Laughs, A Centennial Celebration of the Friars Club, and his name is Barry Daugherty. Barry, thank you for talking to me today. How are you?
I am well, and I'm happy to be here.
So happy to have you here. In doing this podcast, your books have proven to be quite the invaluable resource, so it's greatly appreciated all the work you've done over the years for the Friars Club. But I should start out by asking you what I've asked so many other friars in the past, how exactly you became involved with the Friars. I know you had worked for what is now the Paley Center for some time. How did you transition from that into your work with the Friars?
You know, I wish I had a real exciting story for this, something that screamed real friarly. Basically, they dissolved my job at the Museum of Television Radio at the time, now the Paley Center, as you mentioned. And the assistant to the president had a friend who worked at the Friars Club. She's like, oh, you should go there. They're looking for a temp. And I thought, well, I don't know if I can just handle living as a temp, but sure. So I went over there. They hired me as a temp. And not long after, they had a magazine. It's called The Epistle. And the person who was running it, he passed away. So they were like, oh, wait, didn't you just have a little blurb in the New York Times? Because I was a writer all the time. And I was like, well, yeah, but I never published a magazine. And I just kind of slid into it, and I ended up there for 25 years.
So for those who may not know, tell us about what you would find inside the Friars in-house magazine that you were responsible for all those years.
So their magazine, actually, it had been around since about, 1909 or something. And I actually had, it wasn't an actual, but it was a copy of their one-page magazine. Oh, it was profiles of different members. There was a Live at the Friars. It covered all the events because, we were happening and we had to cover each and everything. It was mainly getting everybody's names in the magazine because people love to see their names, and they would actually complain if they didn't. It would highlight new members. It was a lot going on. It was a lot of fun, and I got to meet a lot of interesting people just by interviewing them for the profiles.
So now tell me how you transitioned from not only writing this magazine into writing whole books about the Friars Club. When you started doing that, how much information was really out there and available to you about the club? And how much of this stuff did you have to find out for yourself in putting the books together?
So it was a combination of both. Basically, what was happening is, I was getting into the Friars. I enjoyed their history. I kept coming across little blurbs about them. And I had a meeting with the executive director, Jean-Pierre Trabeau, at the time. And we were just kind of discussing this wacky history that some of it, I couldn't necessarily believe some of it. A lot of it was handed down from the likes of, Milton Berle and whatnot. So they may have exaggerated things, but I was really interested in trying to get the story out. So we decided, let's see if we can maybe put a book together and just publish it. And it was to start just the history of their roasts. So now I had to, I may have been sorry I started this, because how do I find the history of the roast? They had some things recorded on video, and then prior to that, they were on reel-to-reel, tape recorder. This material was all over the place. And then they didn't even have, obviously, roasts from the 40s, or anything prior to that. They've been around since 1904. So I started to delve into them. They had under the staircase was this closet And it was filled with photographs and clippings and different stories. And I came across this one old friar. He must have been around since practically when they began. And he had all these scribblings, Sari Saranoff. So I got a lot of my stories from him because in his own way, he covered a lot of these events. I also went over to Lincoln Center has a performing arts library, and they have the Billy Rose collection, and they had a lot of material about the Friars Club. So I was able to kind of cull things together, especially for their very early years. And then I just started interviewing people, Milton Berle, Jerry Stiller, Dick Capri. I don't even know where to begin. There were just so many that I just, Phyllis Diller, I just had a blast meeting them all.
You mentioned a name that has come up on numerous occasions on this podcast. That is Jean-Pierre Trabeau. Can you tell me a little bit about who he was and how he became involved with the Friars Club? And what happened to Jean-Pierre? Is he still around?
He is still around. So he's French. So he's from Normandy. So he was very young during the war, but he lived through the war. As a matter of fact, his wife, who has since passed away, her father was a member of the French Resistance. So he has his own fascinating career. And then he was working on ships. I don't know what one calls it. I think of this as customer service, but I don't think it's Julie on the Love Boat, you know, putting events together, but it was more or less running the restaurant bar.
Like a social director of sorts.
Yeah. Well, a little kind of a little bell. So he ended up coming, you know, when he came to the States, he ended up at the Friars Club, and he was there for, well, I don't know, many, many years, 40, 50 years. He was a wonderful man, and he helped with some of the stories because he dealt with Frank Sinatra in his moments of imbibement on shows.
Oh, wow.
And then, he had fun stories about Cary Grant. So he got involved with all these people, but he was so unassuming. And had a great accent.
That sounds like he has a really impressive backstory. Backstory I didn't really even know all that much about, to be quite honest with you, until I went to the Friars Expert, of course. I'm assuming you would go to so many of these different Friars events, roasts, testimonies, and what have you. When you would go, was it more like work for you? I got to concentrate on, you know, getting a certain amount of information down about each different event that you would attend?
Yes, it was working. Luckily, when I was around, they were recording things. So if I needed the information for writing an article or whatnot, that was taken care of. But a lot of my work involved working with the individuals on material. I was head writer for a few of the roasts. And it was kind of working with those performers. The comedians, not so much. They're pretty good. They know what they're doing. I found it challenging to work with some of the non-comedians, because even though you have these celebrities, they're actors and musicians, this is not an event they are used to being a part of. I think one of my favorite stories on the Quentin Tarantino roast, they had asked Uma Thurman if she would be a part of it, and she hesitated. She's like, well, I don't know, maybe, maybe not. Well, as it was my job to coordinate the writers, so it's not like it was just me. So I would have a pool of writers, and I would have them write material for certain individuals, and you know, we sort of break it up. And so we started writing material for her because it wasn't a no. And she kept putting it off. Like, I would try to contact her to say, I'd like to get in touch with you about the material. Okay. And at one point she finally said, look, you know, yeah, send me what you have. So I sent her the material. And I will admit some of that material involved Quentin having a foot fetish. And she's like, all right, I don't want to do any foot fetish stuff. It's fine. It's just, we just throw this out to you, and this is how we work. And she kept, again, she would make appointments to meet, and it wouldn't happen. So finally, she invited me to go to her home. It's down in the village. And I thought, okay, this is great. right before that, actually, I had gotten this attack of sciatica. Like, and I'm thinking, I am officially with old friars. I mean,
that's really the mark of a real friar when you start having sciatica.
It was a full induction. Never experienced it before. So here I am, I'm bent over, and I thought, no, I am going to make this appointment. And at the same time, she had a stalker. So I'm standing on the stoop of her townhouse, and there's a guy in a car, and he's like, are you here to see Uma? And I'm like, oh my God, it's the stalker. I've led him right to her front door. And I'm just ignoring him. And finally, he walks up the stairs, and he's like, so you are here to see Uma? I was like, yeah. Well, he takes out keys, he opens the door. It was her driver, which I think he could have introduced himself a little
bit. And maybe he thought you were the stalker.
Yeah. So he let me inside. I sat down, my broken body, on this couch in the living room. And the layout was, there was a staircase, and this woman comes down, like Cloris Leachman in Young Frankenstein. She's like, you know, Uma can't see you now, you must leave. It's like, what? She's like, no, she can't see. I'm like, but I have sciatica. I said, I can't go. I have an appointment with her. And I just sat on the couch. And I didn't know. It must have been the steroids I had been injected with. So the chauffeur left. She left. And I'm sitting there alone with the dog on the couch. And I'm like, what am I doing here? So anyway, the woman came back down. She said, look, she said she left you a message. And she did. I had been on the subway and I didn't get it. But she said she will contact you. Fine. So I finally, over the phone, I got in touch with her. And when we got to the day, this is how my working days go at these roasts. She came to me and she said, look, I still don't know if I'm going to do this, so I'll give you a high sign, which is not what the producers want to hear, because everything is timed out. Now you don't know. There's a whole lineup. So finally, I'm in the wings, and she's got material that we sent. And she finally gave me the high sign. So she got up. She was amazing. She took her shoe off. She poured champagne into it, and both shoes. She handed one to Quentin. She did the foot fetish bit, and they banged. It was on the cover of the New York Post, or at least inside of it. And so I was like, all this headache, but she was great.
I've seen that video too. That's a great clip. That was a great Friars Roast moment that you could only get, spontaneous, and it was remarkable. So,
and everybody is enjoying that, and meanwhile, this is why I don't have any hair.
Yeah, exactly. Giving you the runaround that whole time. So, how did you get into writing for different people, writing comedy material? Were you always interested in that, or did you get tasked with that and fall into it once you became part of the Friars Club?
Yeah, I think we're going to go with that. I was always a writer and leaning toward humor. You know, I started as a news reporter in Cablevision on Long Island. So, you know, there was such serious news out there. And then when I got to the Friars, it just became natural that I kind of transferred my writing style to something a little more humorous and a little less stodgy. And I'm funny. I was nominated for Biggest Ham in high school, even though I lost to someone very dull, by the way. So it was in me, and I was working, and I lived basically with all of these comedians. So I got the hang of it, and I did just slide into it.
See, now that's very interesting. So when they would do the roasts, what was the process of deciding, A, who would be roasted, and B, who do we want to sit on the dais for that roast?
Yeah, it's a tough job to produce that event. For starters, they choose people who either have something going on at the time. When we roasted Billy Crystal, Mr. Saturday Night was coming out. As a matter of fact, the roast was the day after that premiere. So they try to find a hook. And it's hit or miss, though, once you ask the person do you want to do this? I mean, it helps if they, if you add, we can help promote your show. But then again, some of them don't want any part of it. They approached John Travolta. He said, I will not do a roast. I will do a dinner, because they would also have dinners. People think it's just roast. They also had testimonials that they would do. Once they agreed, yeah, now you've got a dais to fill. The best people to find are the people who know them the best. Because if they know there's a buddy up there who knows every little detail that they do not want out there, they live in fear on that dais when that person gets up, because they don't know if they, what they're going to say or not. So you try to choose those kinds of people. You can also, in terms of choosing the guest of honor, if it's not someone like a movie star or whatever, then you find, you try to get a famous comedian or somebody that's really fun and has a great personality. Again, with the dais, you also have to smatter it with real comedians, and not all of them know who the guest of honor is, but you still want to make it funny. So it's sort of hit or miss who does what and where they plop them in.
So when they decided they were going to start televising the roasts on Comedy Central, which they did for a couple of years, how did you feel about that when they made that decision?
Initially, I was kind of against it. I liked the secrecy. I liked the kind of the privacy about it. And I loved that people knew about the roasts, but they wanted to know what really goes on inside there. And, you know, you're sort of opening the doors. The book sort of started that, because that was one of the things that came up with my discussions with Jean-Pierre. Do we want everyone to know what was actually said? You know, we like the kind of the mystery. So I'll admit that sort of started it. I also wasn't totally on board with the deal that they had made with Comedy Central. And I also had spoken to Johnny Carson at one point about being in my book, but
I was going to ask you about this.
he also brought up why, one of the reasons why he didn't want to get involved is he was not happy that they were televising. I kind of like that the end result, at least of the five that they did for the Friars, but it also kind of bothered me, because initially they were like, you know, our roasts were never black tie in some sort of, you know, stuffy way. It was usually a luncheon. And so everybody could just, you know, whatever, business dress or whatever. They put us in tuxedos, and they made it sort of more. Yeah. So they made it more glamorous. And then after the 5 years, you know, we only had a contract for 5 years, so that they stopped, which was fine. But then they continued it. Also fine. But then they turned it back into, let's be casual and hip and cool, you know, not stuffy like those Friars in the tuxedos, basically. So that kind of bugged me a little. It gave the wrong impression. You know, it made the Friars sound old, and they're not. They created this very hip and happening and wacky event. And that's nothing that some stodgy old, you know, codgers would do.
Well, let's go back a little bit into that history. I know that obviously they had many different dinners and testimonials and what have you, dating back to the earliest years of the Friars, but it doesn't seem to be that the roasts really took shape as we know them today until around the 1950s when Milton Berle got on board. So how did the roasts come to take form the way we know the roasts now?
When they started, and they did, 07, I think they had their very first dinner, because that was big back then. You did a testimonial dinner, you got up and you said really nice things about the person and you gave them an award. Because this particular group, and it consisted of, you know, comedians, but, you know, comedians then were very different than they are now.
Right.
But they still had this group of vaudevillians and burlesque actors and whatnot. So it was sort of a kind of an edgier group to begin with. So they would do these dinners, and suddenly in other organizations where they would have their galas, this group of people would get up and start maybe saying, give a little dig, instead of praising them up the wazoo. They kind of give them a little what for. And it started to get a little wilder and wilder, which was fine for them. But those events also had women at those in there. And you can't start saying these things that they started coming out with in front of women. So basically, Milton Berle, it was 1949, they held their very first roast of Marie Chevalier. But they said, you know, we gotta take this to another level, partly because won't this be fun to create an event? And even back then, they were like, I don't know if this is going to fly, but let's just give it a whirl. And it became Stag. There weren't women members anyway. They didn't let them in until 1988. But they thought, let's try it. And that has morphed into what goes on now.
The Friars Club, when it started, wasn't even called the Friars Club. It was the Press Agents Association.
Yeah, would you real good title.
Yeah, I agree. Would you be willing to share how exactly the Press Agents Association came to be back in 1904?
Yeah, there was a group of 11 press agents, and their job was to get press for their clients, which were Broadway shows, vaudeville shows, whatever. So they would give away free tickets to these so-called reporters who would hopefully come and cover them. And what they realized was they weren't all legit, the people that they were giving these tickets to. They were scalping the tickets or doing whatever with it, giving them away just friends and family. So it became such a problem that these 11 guys got together. They started out, they were at Brown's Chop House and Keene's Chop House down in Manhattan. It's still here. And they would meet every week to kind of figure out the problem. And eventually they figured it out. It was very 20th century. They just blacklisted people. But what came out of it was they had a really good time at these meetings because it wasn't all business. It was smoking their cigars and drinking and just having a really good time. So they thought, you know, this is fun. We don't want it to end, even though we've solved the problem. So let's form a club. So they formed the Press Agents Association. It was, and I mentioned that was a really boring title in front of what I didn't know was a group of press agents. But they have to admit themselves that's dumb. But what happened, these vaudevillians and actors and musicians, they all started hanging out with them because they were their friends. They all worked together. And they realized that at some point, we need a better title. So they came up with the word friars. It's Latin for frater, meaning brothers, because it's ultimately a brotherhood and a fraternity.
There have been so many wild things that have happened at the many various Friars events over the years. One of them that I was interested to hear about, apparently Jimmy Durante, who I'm trying to think of how to contemporize this for people a little bit who may not remember Jimmy Durante. He had a radio show, and he was popular in movies and television. He narrated the Frosty the Snowman holiday special. How did Jimmy Durante end up getting arrested at one of the Friars events?
Jimmy ran a speakeasy. So the speakeasies, you know, you knock on the door three times and then, you know, a little guy will say, and you give the secret password.
And he twice on the pipe, by the way. Yeah.
So he broke the law and they had to arrest him. And apparently they felt the need to arrest him at this event because that's the only place they knew where they would find him. So, yeah, they dragged him off the dais.
That is too funny. I only wish there was footage of that. I was reading in your Centennial Friars book about the Barbra Streisand testimonial back in 1969, and that was sort of an unusual testimonial. Would you care to tell me a little bit about that one and how that one differed from many of the other Friars functions over the years?
Well, again, Barbara is somebody you weren't going to roast. Yeah. So you're going to...
Even at that early stage of her career.
Correct. Yeah, no, they knew them. My favorite part of that is that Don Rickles performed. And he was just Don Rickles. I mean, he got up, he said, Barbara, I never liked you. He was complimenting her mother in a way of basically saying how, you know, you're stuck with this daughter. And I would have cringed if I was in the room. Not, I don't know about Barbara, but I would just think, oh my God, he's, you know, he's a dead man. And then funny enough, I got a phone call from her assistant. It was in, I forget whatever year it was. She was putting together a compilation of her CDs. And she wanted to use a portion of that. Well, she wanted, you know, Don's portion. So she needed our permission to do it. And I thought, oh my God, that's so cool. She wants to everyone to know he didn't like her.
But now you spoke with Barbara for your book. Am I correct in saying that?
I did briefly. It was a very brief call. But you know, she did explain that she loved that event. She thought it was really fun, and she was very proud and honored to be a friar. And they named one of the rooms in recent memory after her, and she came to that event, so to speak. The funny thing for that is when we needed a photo portrait of her, and then different pictures. So I'd contacted her, you know, assistant, and said, look, we need a portrait or picture if you have whatever. This is what I have, or what we're thinking of. So she was fine with what we had. And then when she came to the event, we had the picture up, but she had asked to, you know, meet with me. I'd never actually met her in person. So she has to meet with me. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, what did I do? Did she not like the big portrait we ended up with? And she said, I have another picture here that, you know, for the room itself, if you want to look, use it. And I looked at it and I said, you know, I have a much better picture of this same group. And of course, I'm also thinking, no. You have the right picture. I just handed it to you.
Yeah.
So I went upstairs and I came back down with it, and she's like, oh my God, yes. And also send that to my assistant. So it was a win-win. She's lovely.
She seems lovely. I think she's just one of the great talents of all time, Barbara Streisand. That's undeniable, needless to say. It's funny, you mentioned naming the room after her. How did that tradition start at the Friars Club, naming the different rooms after the famous members of the Friars Club?
I think it's, you know, it's funny. You go to any place, like we mentioned Lincoln Center earlier, you know, there's names everywhere, you know, it's because people who donated money, you know, and okay, now put my name on the elevator, the bathroom or whatever. Actually, the Friars has the Richard Lewis bathroom.
That's right.
He wanted that. But so with the Friars, I think it was more, you know, you've donated your time and your talent and, you know, your legacy in the arts, and we want to honor you with a name. For the most part, I'm sure that's how it happened. They have the Milton Berle Room. I think that was going to happen whether anybody wanted it or not. And he was a forefather of the Friars, so that was good.
Did he not buy what is now the monastery for the Friars for the Friars Club? Do I have that correct?
No, you don't have it correct, but you have it correct of what he would tell people.
Ah, okay.
So you're not wrong. Yeah, that's a wacky story. So so the Friars were looking for a new home, and this building had come up on West 55th Street, and magnificent English Renaissance design, and it was from 1907. And he explained to anyone that will listen that, you know, he looked at it to move in and live there, and his wife came to look at it, and she said, oh no, it's too big, you know, we'd need servant, I don't want to live here, no. So he then very kindly gave it to the Friars. No. So
we're setting the record straight right here on the Friars Club podcast.
The Friars had a real estate agent, and he said, hey, I know this really cool building that's for sale. So he sold it to them. They bought it for like $300,000. Milton Berle, I will admit, did help with the mortgage, and they did pay off that mortgage in like 3 years. So Yeah, that's the story. So you can pick and choose what you want. I know that I destroy fantasy, and that's, I think, my job as a writer or a historian telling these stories. Somebody has to tell the truth, and I'm not always happy because that's a cute little story that you tied up in a little bow.
I'm fascinated to hear all of this. The Friars Club has not always been in that location, obviously, as we just referenced. How many different locations over the years has the Friars Club been in?
So first of all, they were nomadic at these chop houses for a while.
Right.
And then in 1908, they secured a little building. I forget exactly where that location was. And then they started to raise money to build a building in 1916. So they traveled the country and they started this event called the Friars Frolics. And so they would travel around and they do sketches and all this fun stuff. So they raised enough money to have this building built, and they moved in 1916. And it had like four pool tables and gyms and places for people to sleep, banquet halls. I mean, it was perfect for them. And then in 1933, they lost the building because they couldn't pay the like $1,000 dairy bill. So George Jessel, if you're familiar with George Jessel, the Toastmaster sure. General, he was the abbot at the time, which is the head of the club, CEO, call it what you will. So I always felt bad, not that I was around when he was there, but I always felt bad for George, that his legacy for the club is that he lost it at that, they lost the building. And then they
And over a dairy bill, might I add. That's something you don't hear about now. A dairy bill?
No, milk and eggs.
Yeah.
I mean, they paid the gin bill.
Yeah, except who's drinking milk? Other than me, who's drinking milk at the Friars Club?
I don't know. Exactly. So then they became nomadic again, and they had they kind of pulled up stakes at the Edison Hotel. They would take rooms there, and the Edison is still there. And then they found a space on 52nd Street, another building, small building, that they would rent. And then they moved into this. So there weren't really that many buildings.
But they've jumped around over the years.
Then you go into the L.A. Friars, and they had a whole story out there in Beverly Hills.
What are your feelings about the Friars Club in California? Because I know passions run very high around that particular branch of the Friars Club.
Well, I love that they were out there. I also love the story. You know, they went out there because you had the likes of George Burns and Jack Benny and Bob Hope, who were all members. And then they took their shows. They, you know, they had radio shows or out here in New York. So then they started working out there in California. So when they got out there, they're like, "Hey guys, where are we going to go?" So I love that they made a Friars Club, and they carried on the traditions for years. And I love that they brought to the table their own Friars wackiness.
You have yourself become acquainted with and talked to and gotten to know so many of the Friars over the years. And you had gotten a phone call, as you had mentioned earlier, from Johnny Carson when you were running one of your books. How did that come about? And was that just the shock of your life when Johnny Carson was on the other line?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I think people assume, you know, I might be jaded. And on one level, maybe I am. You know, it became happenstance for me to just see these guys and just talk with them. But yeah, my phone rang one day at my desk, and I pick it up, and this woman says, "Hi, is this Barry Doherty?" "Yes." "Hold for Johnny Carson." And like, I was like, wait, no, you don't say that. What? I need preparation. I need a month in advance. Johnny's going to call you on this day.
Yeah.
So I patiently wait. And all of a sudden the line opens as, "Hi, Barry, this is Johnny Carson." I was like, "Oh, yeah, hi." So I had put an ask out because I wanted to talk to him at one of my books. So he said, I got your invitation, and I'm going to tell you why I don't want to be in your book." So, okay. One of it was that he did not like the idea of being on Comedy Central. He didn't want it on, he didn't think they should be televised. Which I said, you know, in all honesty, you know, Mr. Carson, I agree with you. I said, but, you know, I'm happy to write that. That's part of the story. I mean, you don't have to, you just let me talk to you and this is your story. So if that's how you feel, it's honest and there's nothing wrong with saying it. He's, you know, no, but he also, and this bothered me a little though, he said, and I don't like the idea of women roasting. And that bugged me.
Really?
And yeah. I thought, oh, okay. No. And again, I was like, well, then let's talk about that because that transcends the Friars. That talks about women in comedy. And, you know, maybe that's an opinion people would want to hear. So, but he nixed it all. But he was very nice. And, you know, he kept like, you agree with me, right? Well, no, I'm not on that one. I went with you so far.
Yeah. But I find that funny he would say that because he was at Lucille Ball's roast back in the 60s.
Which is what it's my favorite roast story that he introduced. And, you know, by the way, you know, even though women were not members, they still honored them with dinners and roasts. And Lucy was one of the few women in the beginning they roasted. And the poor thing was the only one in the room, the only woman in the room. But yeah, so Johnny got up and he said, so guys, we have a lady here today, so show a little class. And then he introduced her as Lucille Testicle. So, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. And that's why he was such a class act at any roast he did, because that's not filthy, you know? I mean, that's funny, that's wit. And he pulled it off and that was his act. But yeah, so I guess he could, I mean, he appreciated a funny woman and he appreciated her talent and he appreciated that she was all in for this roasting, but he didn't want, I guess, her to get up and be, you know, ribald and say such things. So I think that's where his problem was. It wasn't necessarily he was against female comics, maybe like Jerry Lewis had mentioned, but it was more, I don't want them being showing that side of them. I don't know. I can't really speak for Johnny, but I'm trying to cut him slack.
Yeah, a little bit of slack. But you mentioned Jerry Lewis. How did it come about that Jerry Lewis was going to become the abbot of the Friars Club? And what do you remember about your interactions with Jerry?
We had Frank Sinatra, and then after Frank Sinatra, he was the abbot. After that was Alan King. Then Alan King passed away, and that is when they asked Jerry. It was a natural progression. They would ask these celebrities, very high profile celebrities, preferably comedian, but you know, you had your Frank Sinatra who transcends that. So Jerry was just a natural progression to invite him to be a part of it. And it was fun whenever he came to the club. You could tell there was a different pep in everybody's step. It's like, oh my God, it's not just the abbot, it's Jerry Lewis.
I know that at one point, we were talking about you got a call from Johnny Carson, you had a phone call with John Travolta. What were the circumstances that you had a phone call with Mr. Travolta?
Oh, that was actually me calling him because, you know, he wanted to hear from Barry. I actually...
As anybody would.
I had asked if I could profile him for the epistle. And they got back to me and said, yes, please do. So in trying to go over the schedule of when and where I would call him, you know, I would do these from my office. It was a phone call if they weren't local or if they didn't want to actually be in my presence. So he was in Florida and I was in New York. So it worked out that I had to call him at midnight on like a Saturday night. And then, you know, we could do the interview. So I called him and first I got, hold on one sec or, oh, wait. Let me call you right back. So he calls me back. He said, I'm sorry, I was landing my plane. Now, I don't think he actually took my call while he was landing the plane. I think he was just finishing up whatever pilots do when they get off their plane that lands in their home.
Right.
So, But we had a great chat. We had a lot of fun. He was so cool. And at one point I was speaking, you know, asking him a question, and he stops. He goes, "Where are you from?" And I'm thinking, why would you care? So I said, you know, New York. He said, "You have no hint of an accent. My mother would love you because she was a speech teacher." And then we went into the conversation, and I thought, what a wacky little aside, but
I like true. That.
He's human. You know, it's like he picked up on it because that's how he rolls and that's how he thinks.
That's one of those experiences that'll stay with you forever.
Yeah.
We're talking about how you wrote for some of the different roasts and testimonials over the years. You mentioned Quentin Tarantino's roast. Do you have any recollections of writing for the Betty White roast?
Betty, I love that roast. I worked with Barbara Walters on, because she was the roast master, and she was Barbara Walters. I picked up the phone to that voice one day, saying, "You know, I'm sending you material. Make sure it's funny." And it was funny. She had funny writers, so that was not an issue. But you know, we also added just other things to it and fleshed it out, because that was her sort of intros, or her own introduction. But then we had to write different intros for all the people she'd be introducing.
Right.
I just remember, I just thought it was funny that you don't think about Barbara Walters as being a roast master at a Friars Club comedy event. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And to show you sort of how my head was spinning, I was sitting with her right before we were going on at a desk, and or it was a table at the hotel. And you know, she's saying these funny lines, and oh, should I change that? And the director of the roast came over, and he's like, "Oh, okay. So Barbara," and she just put her hand up like an old, you know, talk to the hand type of thing. She said, "I'm working with Barry. Leave us." And I thought, oh. So now we're back to the Barbara I was expecting. So, but I'm thinking, I hope he knows that, you know, I didn't sit down with her and say, if he comes over here, you know, just get rid of him. So at the end of the roast, and she was brilliant, she came up to me and she said, "How'd I do?" And I also did not see that coming. This is a woman of sheer confidence. So I don't know, that these little things that they did, or my little interactions, they were just so much more human than I think people expect them to be.
I think that is a testament to you, and you're very affable. I think people tend to feel comfortable around you. It speaks to who you are, Barry.
Oh, I'll take it.
Very good. What do you remember about working on the Jack Black roast?
So Jack Black, I got to work with Bob Saget. The Jack Black roast was fun. It was very special. And it was sort of normal. You would think there would have been scads of issues, or just drama, not drama, but goofy silliness, or just bad things. And there weren't. I worked closely with Bob Saget, who was the roast master, who just had great timing. He loved all the jokes, added his own.
Now, you worked on various testimonials, including one for Tom Cruise. What do you remember about the Tom Cruise testimonial?
So Tom Cruise, again, I don't think you roast, you do a dinner.
Right.
Again, really nice guy. That also, unfortunately, that came at the same time where he was having his breakup. His marriage was breaking up. He had his daughter, Siri, was with him, and his son. And unfortunately for me, afterwards, from a communication standpoint, I guess, the press was all about, oh, look how, you know, his breakup is happening, and now he's with the kids. And, you know, it took away from the event. It kind of ruined everything, because all of that news came down right the next day. So, but in the meantime, the show itself was really fun.
Larry King, who was the dean of the club for the last few years of his life, they did a testimonial for Larry King. What stood out to you about Larry King?
Well, for me, when we had the dinner, so Katie Couric was the master of ceremonies for that. And she was a lot of fun. And she was like, you know, give me what you got. And, you know, I'm ready. And I was like, you know, this isn't a roast, right? Like, basically, it was like, damn it. For me, what stands out is she may have been the master of ceremonies, but Donald Trump is the one who gave him the award. So I had to work with Donald to make his remarks. So when he got up to give them, he's not exactly a comedian. So if the points didn't hit right, he basically at one point just looked up and said, you know, I didn't write this. Yeah, okay. Thanks.
And, of course, there was a testimonial for Don Rickles that was conducted. I guess this was the one that was done in 2013.
I did work on that. But again, you know, it's funny. I wanted more. I didn't want it. Now, in talking about them, I wish I had a lot of drama to talk about and things that went awry. But it didn't. Everyone loved, you know, they loved him. And what was amazing is he was getting up there, and but yet he rose to the occasion. I was always impressed right at the gate with, like, people. You had Henny Youngman, if everyone remembers Take My Wife Please. He was when I first started, he was a fixture at the Friars Club, and he was there for many years until he passed away while I was there. And even though he was got to the point where he was in a wheelchair and he was so feeble, we had an event at a smaller stage. He came out, they wheeled him out, they put the microphone in his hand, and you would have thought 50 years dropped off him. He remembered his material, of course, was the same material for the last several thousand years, but he remembered it, and it was amazing. And I felt the same way about Don, to a lesser degree. It's not like he was out of it at that point, but you could tell he was kind of slowing up.
There was a picture in your book of Bill Clinton at the Friars Club. What was that from? Was Bill Clinton a friar? And I just didn't know about this whole time.
Yeah, he is a friar. He came to an event there. It wasn't a friar's event. It was a special event that he was at. And he, before he would go anywhere, you've got to get the dogs have to come through, all the Secret Service comes through. And then eventually, hours later, he comes through. He was just there as part of this event, but he did make a speech. So I have a picture of me standing like on the stage as he's walking by, and I'm thinking, you know, I have tons of these photos where it's just me in the background. I feel like Zelig all over the.
Well, Barry, I could talk to you all day long. Before I let you go, why do you think, after all these years, there is still such a curiosity surrounding the Friars Club? Why is the public still so enamored of this organization after over 100 years in existence?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I can't think of any organization that's been around for over 100 years that people are still talking about. They're the bad boys of entertainment. It's not even just comedy. I mean, there's musicians and writers and directors. The things that just happen to them and that they make happen, they make people laugh and they make people think too, because it's like, they still are interested in what goes on behind those doors. We may have opened them a crack for Comedy Central or books or whatever, but there's still a lot of fun that's going on back there.
Well, Barry, all I can say is thank you for joining in the fun on this podcast. I hope you had fun. It was truly a delight to talk to you because it's very rare that you meet somebody who truly is an authority, if not the authority, on the Friars Club. So thank you for sharing your wealth of knowledge. I hope to have you on again. This was truly a delight.
It was. I had a lot of fun, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.